I was 45 years of age when I had my first success with a hurley. I came from a GAA family. I believe it was my father who suggested the name for our local GAA club, the hugely successful Coola of Dalkey. My two immediate older brothers were capable hurlers at school and club level. I remember being pointed out at my primary school, Dinna Ella de Vinturi Rishkiol, by Shegamaha Gamont, he'll be good at hurling. Ach nimara hiltar a beater. My hurling skills never took off, literally. I was confined to ground hurling, as I had, at best, only a 50-50 chance of striking the schlitter in the air. In fairness to my older brother, Colman, he tried his best. I remember a summer's day when he took me out to practice in the back garden of the wooden chalet my father had built in West Cork for our holidays. On two sides of the garden are country ditches in which a small ball could easily be lost. On another is the chalet. On the fort is a long wooden shed where we stow our rowing boat in winter. Colman decides that this will be our goal. There are two glass windows in the shed, but this isn't the problem, as Colman knows I can't possibly hit the schlitter hard enough that he wouldn't be able to stop it. I scoop up the schlitter, swing at it, and miss. Bantri lela as, says Colman. Try again. Up goes the schlitter, I swing again, and miss again. Arish, says Colman. Okay. I steady myself, take a deep breath, raise the schlitter in the air, swing, and the boss of the hurley smacks the schlitter, sending it past my brother and smashing one of the glass windows. My first reaction, shock. My second, fear of my father, who was out upon us in an instant with a scowl on his face. In Annam Day, lads, ked a rinishiv. He never cursed. In Annam Day was as rough as it got. But Colman knows how to play it. With a wry grin, he says, "A yad, scorol fachna cool duchrette, nira sobulte e a stoppa." Fachna scored an incredible goal, Dad. I couldn't stop him. My father looks at Colman, at the broken window, at me. My heart stops. And then my father's face softens and he smiles. There will be no tortamach for this broken window. Anything that raises the prospect of his youngest son finally getting to grips with a hurley is to be welcomed. And a broken window is a small price to pay. Alas, it was a false dawn. A fluke. A lucky strike. In another reality, my name must be Lightning, for I certainly didn't strike twice. In secondary school, my skills deficit became ever more apparent. At best, I was put onto the pitch for the last few minutes of a friendly match. Eventually, I started mitching off GAA training, along with a few other no-hopers, for it was GAA or nothing in those days. For whatever reason, Bonnishdor didn't try too hard to find us. Years later, with my two young sons registered in Coola, I once again picked up a hurley as I wanted to help them develop their skills. Nothing had changed. I still had only a 50-50 chance of hitting the schlitter, but I struggled on. One day, however, my wife Mary went out with the boys, picked up a hurley, and took a perfect shot at the rebounder in the back garden. Beginner's luck, perhaps? Then she did it again, and again, and again. Nowadays, I concentrate more on the football end of things. Did I mention that my wife is from Kilkenny? But I finally achieved my great hurley moment. A number of years ago, I started keeping a hurley in my bedroom wardrobe. This was due to a rather unstable and unpredictable individual taking a dislike to me, and my concern that he might turn up at my house someday. Fortunately, it never came to that. But one night, as I'm giving my infant son his bottle of milk by the bedroom window, I look out on the road just in time to see a young man leap over my neighbour's front gate and run into the shadows. A break-in in progress. I know the house next door is vacant, so I ring the Gardaí and wait. And wait. After 20 minutes with no sign of help, I grab my hurley and venture out our side door into the passageway between our house and our neighbour's one-storey garage. I can hear voices, but I can't tell exactly where they're coming from. I continue into the back garden and look up to see two figures on the garage roof. Waving my hurley, I shout at them to get the you-know-what out of there. In the darkness and taken by surprise, perhaps they mistake me for a fearsome Cuchulain Zeus-like figure, rather than a skinny 5'5" failed hurler. They flee, jumping down from the roof and running out onto the road. I pursue them, yelling and brandishing my hurley. They are, thankfully, faster runners than I am this night, and are hopping into a waiting getaway car halfway down the road by the time I am out of my front gate. Not long after, at a family get-together in the local pub, I regale my older brothers with my story. For once, I think they are impressed. And I like to think that my late father finally got his money's worth for that broken window.
It was just as Bob Dylan told us, the times they are a-changing. All around the world that year, the levers of power were being switched. De Gaulle and Franco stood down. Colonel Gaddafi took over Libya in a bloodless coup, and both Palestine and Israel got new leaders, Yasser Arafat and Golda Meir. In Ireland, the situation was volatile. As I stood with my fellow students on the cobbles of Front Square in Trinity College, activists addressed us from the dining hall steps. Ernie Bates, the Maoist David Vipond, and red-bearded Greg Murphy all tried to wake us up to the worsening situation in the North. And of course, they looked beyond troubles at home to the war that was devastating Vietnam and neighbouring Cambodia. It was against this backdrop that a new president of the USA was sworn in at the beginning of 1969, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Rebellion and protest were in the air. Conscripts in the USA were burning their draft cards or slipping over the border into Canada. The film Easy Rider made heroes of young men on motorbikes with bandanas round their heads. Dennis Hopper reeking of attitude and Peter Fonda exuding sexiness. On the other side of the coin, John and Yoko famously stayed in bed for days recording Give Peace a Chance from their hotel room. I was to make my first trip to this America of dissent, having found a summer job at a hospital. Young people were being hired to stimulate institutionalized patients, taking them for picnics and so on. The reality was less rosy than I'd imagined. The state psychiatric hospital in Middletown, Connecticut, had thousands of patients, many of them deeply unresponsive. As the only European, all the rest were Americans studying psychology or sociology, I was well out of my depth. But the rest of the team befriended me. They were incredulous when I told them I'd never had a Big Mac in my life and rushed me to the nearest Golden Arches as if to a baptism. Plus, I had an aunt in Rhode Island. When I visited her in mid-July, she urged me to come and watch as Neil Armstrong stepped onto the surface of the moon. I declined haughtily, saying I wasn't impressed. Those astronauts were just the puppets of Houston. True courage was shown by those early explorers who set out in wooden ships, never knowing if they'd fall off the edge of the world. While an estimated 500 million people looked on with awe, I stayed in another room, smug and superior. A few weeks later, five of us saw a poster in Middletown. A bird perched on the neck of a guitar told us of a concert in neighbouring New York State. And on impulse, we decided to head for Woodstock. In Marsha's air-conditioned saloon, with Born to be Wild as our soundtrack, we sped along until a line of parked cars and vans painted in psychedelic patterns blocked the road. Following the sound, we suddenly found ourselves looking down on an ocean of bodies swaying to music that boomed from a massive stage. The organizers had failed to erect the fences in time, so announced it was a free concert, and 500,000 people showed up. And every last one of those 500,000, I swear, had long hair and wore beads, like we did. The lineup was, a word of the time, mind-blowing. Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Janis Joplin, Joe Cocker, Jefferson Airplane were among the many on the bill, and the acts played day and night over the 3 days of the festival. Some locals arrived on the fringes of the crowd, selling soda pop and homemade cookies. But if you didn't have any bread, man, that was all right. You could just share what your brothers and sisters had. We were in Arcadia with flowers in our hair. Our gang from the hospital had come unprepared, of course, so we took it in turns to crash out in the car, a long trudge away. With no fresh clothes to change into, we just splashed on some patchouli. In those days, designer wasn't in our vocabulary. Phil and Marsha came from affluent homes, but they dressed like everyone else, jeans, flip-flops, and a cheesecloth shirt. Some of us tied bandanas round our foreheads too, in a bid to look extra rebellious. How did we get by with little food and less sleep? I can't recall. Didn't Phil go missing for a whole morning? We didn't fret. He'd be back. It'd be groovy. Nobody wanted to be a drag. We were uplifted and living on adrenaline. All around us, people were dancing, a few of them naked, and the air was scented with marijuana, which was being openly traded or given away. A scrawled message on a cardboard sign read, "Feel like a toke? Apply within." Mellow was our watchword, and there was not a hint of violence. We'd come to get away from that. Country Joe caught the mood with his satirical song. "And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Hallelujah, don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam." A couple of months later, a great crowd of young people assembled again, this time outside the White House, in a giant moratorium against the Vietnam War. The national mood had swung away from the Hawks. The Doves were in the ascendant, and for a time, peace and love seemed to hold sway. In today's angry world, I'd love to see a return to that Woodstock spirit of tolerance.
"60 years ago, wells went dry. It was the long Indian summer of 59. We were all Indians, Sioux and Crow, Choctaw and Apache. Medicine men put ears to the ground, did rain dances, smoked peyote woodbines on hilltops. Blankets were scorched, making smoke signals. Water diviners took long strides through blonde meadows. Divining rods remained inert in their hands. Our medicine men had no answers. Our priests could only gulp the Madeira sherry that was supposed to be for higher purposes. Our native crows hid in the branches and boughs. We poked hard sods at them with our hurleys. There wasn't a drip from the taps. A knuckle wrapped on the water tank gave back only a hollow sound. Garden hoses stayed hanging on pegs in sheds. Tractor-tanned farmers took to the roads with barrels, queued up wherever there were deep springs and sloshed buckets of deep earth water into their barrels. They couldn't let the cows go dry. It was the same in towns. Beetles made their homes up taps. Water levels so low that rocks rose out of riverbeds and waterweed was yellow and smelly as the corpses of serpents. In the cities, people drank the Maiwadi undiluted. There was no laundry to hang on clotheslines. Dublin, Cork and Limerick and Belfast all smelled of bake and empty drain pipes and crackled of static and brine nylon and flakes of lux. So we went to watering holes far away by the sea to cool down. Bonmahan, Dunmore East, Ballycotton, Curraghclough. The All-Ireland hurling series ran endlessly through that long Indian summer, created the crescendos of Sunday afternoon radios. And when we arrived home from the foamy, refreshing sea in the evenings, our 12 cows were waiting by the gate, hoofing the dust, and would only yield a few buckets of milk between them, would hardly raise a froth. Except there was always energy for one topic, the hurling. There was a man of our town come home from the wars of his life, come home with a metal plate in his head from wounds received, and a big green parrot who'd sailed back across the sea with him to the Emerald Isle, only to be caged in a tiny kitchen. On matchday Sundays, this man would pace by his radio, listening to the commentary, while the parrot would shriek, "It's a long way to Tipperary." To the top of Slieve na Mon, he was known as the Killinall Parrot. But that summer, his gizzard was so rasped by drought, he couldn't even croak. And maybe he thought, why should he be bothered? Tip weren't in the All-Ireland anyway. The neighbouring counties of Waterford and Kilkenny were grabbing the spotlight in 59. And the parrot's owner had no inclination to teach him to recite the Rose of Muncoin or the old Dungarvan Oak, but could only mooch around town, the ancient mariner, nor any drop to drink. Match day arrived on the 6th of September, hot as the hoops on Eddie Cahir's hurley. That day, Tom Chiesty scored a memorable point, storming past Kilkenny backs. "As though they were dying wasps," commentator Michael O'Hare said. The match ended in a draw. Michael O'Hare was exhausted at his microphone, and our journeys to the foamy seas along the coasts went on until the replay. Only now it was dark as we came home, and still the cows had to be milked, and still water had to be hauled. The hurling replay was set for October the 4th. The parch of the country would not abate. Fever was rife. Hurling fever. 30 stripped-down men manning the gap against lethargy. Talk was of Chiesty and Grimes, Cahir and Clahasy, men spoken of in the same tones as the heroes of Thermopylae. At the replay, in the month of Halloween, the roofs on the stands of Croke Park rattled in their nuts and bolts with the rumble. And when the final whistle sounded, the white and blue of Waterford came out on top. Supporters streamed from the ground, a river of colour. And then, later that month, the rain did come. It clarioned with a clap of thunder from the dark southwest. At first, a few drops, huge drops that rolled like marbles in the dust. Then the wind rushed in until the sound of it over roofs was like a thousand boys running sticks along iron railings. Hens ran for indoor roosts. The rain had come, marching over roofs of farm after farm, street after street, town after town. Torrents rolled into the cracks of hard earth. filled the wells and streams and rivers until worms rose and the hens flew out again, and the stock of hurlers was renewed, and youth had its fling and was ready for the following year, when would come new hurlers, new teams, and last year's teams would become legend. 60 years on, and each year the wells spring anew. Sap of bending ash, splashing strides through puddles, sideline cuts with rainbow spray of dew. Camogie girls trampolining on a risty, well-watered sod. Each year a new promise, coming from upsleeve bloom, coming along the banks of the Lee, Liffey, Shannon, Lagan. This year, it comes from bubbling Tubridorn and from the river Nore that flows gently along. Deep in Davy Jones's locker, a parrot is polishing up his motto. A man with the iron plate in his cranium is again prancing the sidelines of his radio. Crows are dancing on pancakes of dried cow dung. Rain dancing. The spirits of the waters. Undercurrents. Ishka Fuihalev.
One of the great things about living in Europe, even on this damp little island on its northwestern edge, is the opportunity to take a short flight to places that are very different to here. We have a panoply of culturally rich cities almost on our doorstep, coupled with a myriad of sun-drenched holiday destinations. But that said, there is something magical about taking some time out right here in Ireland. Mind you, those of us of a certain age may first have to overcome traumatic memories of childhood family holidays. Many of us are still haunted by those awful endless car journeys where, if you were the youngest, you possibly shared the boot with the dog in a car with almost no suspension, and where the only respite was stopping for a roadside picnic of ham sandwiches and warm diluted orange. When you finally arrived at your holiday home, it was most likely drafty and devoid of much comfort, the kind of place that made you feel you were in fact camping, albeit within solid walls. Back in the day, holiday homes were generally found through the small ads in the newspaper, which came with very limited descriptions, given that every word cost money. These days, we can spend hours online finding that perfect holiday house. We can see what it looks like, we can read reviews, so that the camping element is generally a thing of the past, unless, of course, you choose to actually go camping. But the best thing about holidaying at home is that you can joyfully throw all caution to the wind when it comes to packing. It has taken years for most of us to learn how to squish the bare essentials for a long weekend into a tiny suitcase and how to decant toiletries into miniature bottles that fit into one Ziploc bag. And yet, we still worry all the way to the boarding gate that we will be separated from our beloved luggage at the very last minute. But travel by car and you can just load up with everything you might need, along with all the stuff you probably won't, just for the hell of it. You can throw in as much liquid as you like, along with your entire winter and summer wardrobe, both of which you will likely need in summer in Ireland. "Should I take wellies?" they ask. "Sure, throw them in the car," says you, "along with your hairdryer, your straightener, two pairs of sneakers, the entire contents of your bathroom, four pairs of sandals, your favourite pillow, and the dog." Now, of course, a holiday in Ireland isn't all plain sailing. Ah, no. You may not have to manage your luggage, but you will most certainly have to manage expectations, especially when it comes to weather. The first thing is to make sure that all in your party know the mantra. You know the one. "Sure, we don't come to West Cork or Kerry or Connemara or Donegal for the weather, now do we?" Because the truth is, we all live in constant hope of good weather in summertime. But the sun is a fickle companion on Irish holidays. He may surprise you with lots of appearances, or he may not appear at all, and you will need ways to amuse yourself under leaden skies. Let me tell you, dear listener, I am just back from one of my favourite places on earth, deep in West Cork. I had been there almost a week before I felt the sun kiss my skin. And I'm not going to lie, the place is beautiful, but it looks way more beautiful under blue skies and sparkling sunshine. So make sure that once you arrive at your destination, you find the places that serve the best coffee, that have the best cakes. Search out the great markets and the kind of walks you prefer, be that meandering along boreens between hedges of fuchsia and crocosmia, or hiking up a hill for a panoramic view. And of course, find your favourite pub, somewhere you can wander into at any time, alone or in company, and feel at home and comfortable. Because that is the key to a holiday in Ireland, relaxation and stress-free familiarity. It may not thrill you in the way that standing in front of the Trevi Fountain might, but Ireland can be very soothing. It is the silence, the slower pace of life, the sound of the sea, the moo of a cow, the fragrant summer air, and ultimately, for those of us who are city dwellers, the opportunity to connect with our rural selves that provides balm for the soul.
My first All-Ireland hurling final was back in 1963, when I sat on my mother's knee in the Cusack stand, furiously waving a black and amber Kilkenny flag, while infuriating the Waterford supporter sitting behind us. The Waterford man was infuriated not just with my childish cheering and flag-waving, but by Eddie Kerr's marksmanship. Eddie scored a record 14 points on the day, and Kilkenny won the game on a scoreline of 4-17 to Waterford's 6-8 as Seamus Clear from Bennett's Bridge lifted the Lee McCarthy Cup. I have been to every All-Ireland hurling final featuring Kilkenny since, and I have experienced the agony of losing and the ecstasy of winning. I was drenched to the skin back in 1973 when Limerick beat us in a downpour. We had no Eddie Kerr, of course, that day. And I was stunned and numbed in 1998 when Offaly, whom we had beaten in the Leinster final, ran us ragged to take home Leam. Agony, however, yielded to ecstasy in the 2000s, thanks to the epic achievements of Kilkenny manager Brian Cody, who has led the Cats to 11 All-Ireland titles since he took over in 1999, including the fabulous 4 in a row. Still at the helm, Brian has also seen Kilkenny overtake Cork and Tipperary in the record books. The Cats, with 36 titles, lead Cork by 6 and Tipperary by 9, a stat that, barring a draw, will change today. The last Hurling All-Ireland final I attended was back in 2016, which ended in agony, as Tipperary, our arch rivals, beat us and took the Lee McCarthy Cup back to Thurles. I won't get into the heartbreak of that game, but what I will get into is how, after the match, my travelling companion Jimmy and myself got into a rickshaw, a two-wheeled hooded vehicle that was pedal-powered as opposed to the traditional hand-drawn one. Because of Jimmy's bad knee and my bad hip, we very much needed a taxi. And needless to say, as 82,000 people or so poured out of Croke Park, any taxis in the vicinity were quickly snapped up. Undaunted, we walked along, hailing every passing taxi, but to no avail. And then, out of sheer frustration and exhaustion, we flagged down a youngster pedalling along on a rickshaw. Actually, it was Jimmy who flagged him down and suggested that we hop in, the thinking being that if half a loaf is better than no bread, then a rickshaw is better than no taxi. And in we hopped. Hopped, we laboriously clambered in. And away we went, like the hammers of hell. This youngster, and God bless his youth and strength, overtook cars, buses and taxis, leaving all in our wake and leaving Jimmy and myself a little worried lest we be ejected as the rickshaw careered around some corner or other, leaving us spread-eagled at the feet of some Tipperary fans. We needn't have worried, however, as we were soon caught up in traffic and crawling along, which was fine by us, as we were in no hurry to get home where the doom and gloom of defeat was spreading across city and county like a pall of black smoke. And as we crawled calmly along in the rickshaw, we were able to chat to our fellow county men and women, a tad surprised by our mode of transport, with whom we sympathised and empathised over our depressing defeat. We even managed to graciously congratulate some jubilant fans from the Premier County as we finished off, at our leisure, the last of our ham sandwiches. Back in our car, and now crawling down the motorway in heavy traffic, Jimmy and myself concluded that travelling by rickshaw is not half bad and has its benefits. Indeed, this All-Ireland Hurling Final Sunday, we'll be quite happy to depart Croke Park and environs by rickshaw with, I hope, the Rose of Moon coin ringing in our ears and the black and amber flags fluttering victoriously in the August evening air.
On this morning's programme, we heard My Great Hurling Moment by Fáchtna Ó'Driscoll, Peace, Love and Woodstock by Margaret Hickey, The Killinall Parrot by Leo Cullen, The Moo of a Cow Can Be Balm to the Soul by Barbara Scully and Riding Rickshaw from Croke Park by Jerry Moran. This morning's music was Marchlua I Néil by Sean O'Riada, Woodstock by Joni Mitchell, It's a Long Way to Tipperary, sung by John McCormack, and Sunshine and Showers by Martine O'Connor. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio player, and further details are available on rte.ie/radio1. Sunday Miscellany.